listening to Sam in the Morning, only on LA Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome back to the show. Today's December 5th, and as the week is winding down, we have a perfect guest in the studio today because she's a filmmaker. Well, I don't know if you're perfect, but you seem like a perfect person to me.
Thank you.
We have Jasmine Mostafari on the show. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. You're a filmmaker, and you made a film called Motherland, and we're going to find out all about it. It's about Iranian life in post-Vietnam America. And, I'm really curious how you got to that because you are young, you know, you were born after the Vietnam War, right?
Yes. Yeah, yeah. Okay. I was born in the late 80s.
Yeah. Okay. So it's amazing that people connect with times before they even were born, you know?
Yeah.
And that's very interesting. You told me you're from Canada, right?
Yeah.
So are you visiting now? You visiting LA?
We're here because Motherland is on this four-year consideration campaign. So we have to promote it. You know, mm-hmm. It's a lot of promotions.
Yeah.
A campaign for the Academy Awards is very, a lot of work.
Yeah.
So yeah, we're here from Toronto just for a few days to do screenings. We were at a Variety event last night.
Oh, wow.
Our EP is Ardian Moyed, who's from the HBO show Succession,
mm-hmm.
and he is supporting us
as
executive producer in this.
Very nice. Yeah. So you're eyeing the Oscars, huh?
We're eyeing it, yeah. We're trying.
Well, you have a good chance because you're working with Catherine, and Catherine has very successful clients, you know, and the movies usually end up on the short list at least. I know a couple that won over the years. We've worked with her for a long time. So you're in good company, you know?
Yes, totally.
Definitely you were smart to pick her. How long have you been working with Catherine? For a while?
Just for this campaign. I think we started in September.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Yeah. When was the film completed?
We shot it at the end of 2022, and it was completed early 2023. It premiered at the Toronto International Film Festival.
Mm-hmm. Which is a big deal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it won the Best Canadian Short Award there.
Really?
Yep.
Congratulations.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And then it went on to play, you know, in the U.S. and it won at Aspen and Holly Shorts, which is a local,
right.
You know, Hollywood film
festival.
Yeah,
that was a couple weeks ago, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it won awards at all those. So with every award, it became Oscar qualified even once again. So we had won three Oscar qualifying awards and we thought, you know, maybe we should try for this.
Yeah, definitely. And go to Hollywood and promote.
Yes, exactly.
So were you born and raised in Toronto?
I was born in the middle of Canada in a place called Saskatchewan, which is very much like the prairies, you know, like flatland.
Right.
And then we moved to closer to Toronto and I grew up outside of Toronto.
I see. Okay. And so you wrote about Iranian life. Are your parents Iranian?
My dad. So the film is about my parents.
Oh.
Mostly about my father, Babak, who came to the U.S. at the end of the 70s,
mm-hmm.
While the Iranian Revolution was gaining speed.
Mm-hmm.
And then he actually went to the U.S. In real life, he met my mother, who's Canadian, in Canada. But for the sake of the film, it takes place in the U.S. in Iowa during 1979, during the height of the Iran hostage crisis.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay, and we'll get more into the movie. I just want to get a little background. So he came, did he see it coming? He saw the revolution coming. He thought, I'm going to leave?
I think so. I think it was a combination of things. I think, you know, back then in the 70s for young Iranians, there was this appeal of the U.S. to go have education somewhere else.
Right.
And so, you know, he might have, I think they started to see signs of the revolution, but I'm not sure if that's why he left. I think he was just a very curious young man who was enticed by the American dream.
Yeah.
And wanted to come here.
How old was he when he came out here?
Around 19.
19. So was he going to college and things like that?
Yeah. He went to Massachusetts first.
Yeah.
With a bunch of young guys from Iran, and one of his friends was really, my dad didn't have money, but one of his friends was really rich. So I think they were just honestly being dudes, like going out, chasing American girls, like, and then the hostage crisis happened and it changed and then he left. But I think also school in the U.S. was expensive for him.
Yeah.
So Canada was cheaper.
Oh, I see. Okay. Mm-hmm. So he moved to Canada before he went to school?
I think he might have actually, no, he went to school in Massachusetts a little bit, but not for very long.
So he couldn't afford to continue? Is that what happened?
He couldn't afford to continue. And then with the hostage crisis for all the Iranian students, it was just too hard for them. People didn't want them there.
Really?
So it was a combination of things.
Yeah. People were mixing up the people. They didn't realize who the bad guys and the good guys are.
Exactly.
That's usually the case, you know, when something happens in other countries, you know, people don't understand really what's going on.
Yeah.
You know, and it's unfortunate, you know, because Iranian people are cool, you know, I mean, and I've always felt that way, you know, and I'm from the Middle East, too. I'm from Israel. Mm-hmm. So I've met many over the years, and they have nothing to do with the revolution. Even today, yeah. Right? I mean, many people there do not want the regime there. They want to have life like they had before.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And life in Iran was amazing before that, right? Before the revolution.
Yeah, I think there was there were still issues, obviously. And that's why the revolution came, because right. I think there was also some mismanaging of resources and who benefited from it. So there was always issues, but I think they thought something better was coming, and it wasn't.
Yeah.
And my grandmother was there for a long time too, and so I asked her about how it changed. It changed very slowly for them.
I see.
But yeah, I think they just want freedom like anybody else, you know, and not to live in a dictatorship, and because the culture, Iranian culture, is so beautiful, but you can't, right. And it's full of singing and dancing and right. enjoying, and you can't really do that publicly.
Yeah, you can't express it, huh?
No.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Have you been back there at all?
I've never been to Iran because there's always this a lot of diaspora immigrant Iranians who came and are my, you know, sort of baby boomer age. They're always very afraid for their kids to go.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there's always been this fear of, oh, don't go. And especially because I'm a filmmaker, I don't know, you know,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
You really don't know. So it's too much of a risk.
Yeah.
I feel maybe, I don't know. I could be wrong. Other people who I know, my friends have gone.
Yeah. I know. I would be scared too, you know. I mean, you don't know what's going to happen, yeah. You know. And after you taste freedom in the United States and that's all you've known, it's scary to go to places like that, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't blame you at all, you know.
Yeah.
I probably wouldn't go either.
Yeah.
But, and your life obviously is here. You have friends and family here and stuff, right?
Well, I'm in Canada, yeah. Yeah.
In Canada, I mean, right. So it's not like, do you have a lot of family left back there?
No, most of them have come to Canada,
right.
or like San Diego or something like
I
that.
I see,
and,
okay.
And also part of LA. But I'm close with my family, my Iranian family in Toronto.
I see, okay.
Yeah.
And your mom, was she born and raised in Toronto as well?
She was born in the middle of Canada. I don't know, I guess it would be similar to North Dakota place,
okay.
You know, but in Canada.
Right.
That's
right.
Where she was born.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay. And how did they meet?
They met at university in Canada.
Oh, okay.
It was the cheapest university you could go to. My dad found, because he went studied medicine.
Oh.
He was like, what's the cheapest medical program I can go to? Is University of Saskatchewan. Saskatchewan's a province.
Right.
And that's where they met.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's like Alberta and all the other.
Yeah. My mom's from Alberta, and they went to school in Saskatchewan, which is a very big farm province, and that's where the school was, and they met there.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's kind of unusual, right? I mean, people come, they try to go to famous colleges and stuff like that, but he found what he wanted somewhere in the middle of Canada.
He had lived in Canada when he was young, but in Quebec, which is a French province, because his father, they were looking for doctors from Iran to come, because a lot of Iranians at that time spoke French as well.
Okay.
The Shah was very interested in bringing French culture to Iran. Uh-huh. So my grandfather spoke French, and they went. So my dad lived in Quebec. He had a good memory of Canada,
he
went back there. But it's also because he didn't have money. So he's where can I go where there's it's cheap?
You make the best of it.
Yeah.
So is he a doctor now?
Yes. I mean, well, he actually passed away 11 years ago.
Oh, wow.
But he was a doctor right up until the end of his life. Family doctor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he passed rather when you were pretty young.
I was 26.
Yeah. Oh, you were 26.
Yeah.
So you could handle it pretty much, but it was difficult.
I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know about handling.
Yeah, yeah.
I was still,
that's true.
You know, you're 26 is still, in this day and age, you know, you're almost like a kid still.
Yeah, you still feel young and stuff, yeah. Besides, it always affects you. It doesn't matter how old you are.
Yeah.
You know? It's just that I feel for people that lose their parents early on because the parents miss out so much on seeing the kid grow and everything,
oh,
you know.
Oh, for sure.
And things like that. I was fortunate my parents passed in their at a later age, you know. So, but I still miss them like crazy.
Of course.
It's been 5 years already. So, do you have any siblings?
Yeah, I have two. I'm the oldest of three, and my siblings are we're all like 2 years apart.
I see. Yeah. And your mom raised you on her own, pretty much.
Well, they divorced. No, because my dad. They were married, but they divorced when I was nine.
Oh.
But I would go back and forth between their places. So they each kind of raised me as single parents.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I see. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was divorced. My kids were very young when I divorced and stuff, you know. So they grew up with divorce all their life, you know. Mm-hmm. But they're pretty well adjusted, you know. I mean, there's no reason not to be, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Interesting. So so you grew up there. Did you go to college?
I did. I'd gone to university in Canada for a few different things before I went to film.
Okay.
I didn't grow up knowing I could be a director. I just, you know, especially there's not a lot of female directors. Now there's more. Mm. But back then, like in the, you know, 2010s, there wasn't a lot of examples. I didn't think that was a career I could do, but I was so interested in film and writing.
Right.
So I went to school for journalism first for a year, and then I switched and I studied film theoretically. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, no, I want to make films. So eventually I went to a program at a university called Toronto. It used to be called Ryerson. Now it's called Toronto Metropolitan University, mm-hmm. downtown Toronto, 4-year program. I went in, I was like, I want to be director. I never looked back. Like,
really?
I was just like, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So that sort of occurred to you when, at a certain point, when you're already in school?
Yeah. I was about
studying something else.
I was about 20, and I was studying film, mm-hmm. Theoretically, like learning about, you know, Eisenstein and like all these like early filmmakers, and we were watching old films. Mm-hmm. And then in the other university I was at, there was a filmmaking program, and I was like in classes with them.
Right.
And I said, oh, I want to do what they're doing. Yeah. I don't want to just study it.
Yeah.
I want to be the director behind it.
Right.
Have
you ever thought about acting at all, or you like to be behind the camera?
Behind the camera. When I was young, I was like really, I was like, oh, I want to be an actor. But as I got older, I was like, no, you're behind the scenes person. Yeah.
Very nice. So did you feel that there was a chance for a career in this when you first started? When you went to school?
Yeah, I had to believe that there was a path to a career. I knew it would be hard.
Yeah.
Because when I started university, I was 20, for not started university, but when I started film school, mm-hmm. I was 21. So I wasn't as naive. Like, I knew this would be a hard path.
Yeah.
In terms of, and financially, certainly. And it has been. Like, it's a career of a lot of sacrifice because you don't have a lot of, most filmmakers will never have a lot of money.
A lot of money, right?
A few, you know, and but I actually have been, I made a feature film called Firecrackers after I graduated with my producing partner, Caitlin.
Wow.
And
a full feature?
Yeah.
Right out the gate, huh? Pretty
well, much. In at our thesis film, we made a short film. It also played at Toronto International Film Festival and all over the world. So we made a mm-hmm. short film called Firecrackers in our last year that did really well, and it played around the world.
What was that about?
It's about two girls who want to escape a small town,
uh-huh.
and then something bad happens to one of them, and it threatens their friendship.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and that was 15 minutes,
mm-hmm.
shot on 16mm film, and that kind of like, it didn't launch our careers, but it started like this, like, we can do this. And then a few years later after we graduated, we were working, you know, I was working for a producer, and then I was writing, and we made a feature film.
Right.
Called Firecrackers, and that launched our career.
I see. Okay. And that was like, was that like the same movie but expanded?
Exactly. Yeah.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow. Yeah. That's a big deal to make a feature film. I mean, early on in your career too, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. You have to get financing and all that stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And and you've known Caitlin all this time? Caitlin just in right here, and she's watching us. And you're the producer, right? She's the producer of, of Motherland.
Yes.
And did you produce all the other films you were with?
Yeah. We met we met in school in 2009. So we've been working together since then.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Wow, very cool.
Yeah.
So you're a team.
We're a team.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Very nice. So you made the feature film. Did you did you market it at all or?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And did it go pretty well?
Yeah. It was a New York Times critics pick. It was reviewed well by the LA Times, the Hollywood Reporter, Variety.
Wow.
It played in Europe at Zurich. It won at the Stockholm International Film Festival. It got me representation in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Agents and managers. It also was, I was able to start directing TV after that.
Really?
So that's also my other career. Well, it's connected, but, you know, I'm a TV director as well.
Right. Mm-hmm. So you view yourself as a director. You don't get into producing or anything.
No, not me. No, not personally. I feel like I like to focus. Otherwise, you spread yourself too thin, I think. So I'm like, I like to write and then be director for hire and direct my own stuff. And
yeah. Was there a pretty big cast in the film, in the feature film?
No. It was a super small indie film and it was made for $250,000 Canadian, which I don't know how much that is in U.S. I think it's about $180,000 or something like that, which is a very small budget for a feature film.
Yeah, that's true.
Mm-hmm. So it was like an unknown cast, kind of non-actors, gritty, quite a gritty film, energetic but slightly dark and about women. And that was like it did as well as a indie Canadian film could probably do.
Right. And did you write the film as well? Okay, so you're not just a director, you're a writer as well.
Yeah.
All your films, you write all your films?
So far.
Yeah. So you're very creative. I mean, you know, to get ideas out of thin air, it's not easy.
No, it's definitely, it's not. it's like, writing is very daunting, you know.
Yeah. Were you interested in writing early on in your life?
Yeah.
Were you writing a lot?
I was always a creative writer from a very young age. Mm-hmm. I wrote short stories when I was young.
Uh-huh.
And they seemed to be very emotional short stories, stories with a lot of character. And then I loved visual art. So these two things, I think, kind of led me to film because it's a combination of expression through visuals and through words.
Right.
But I didn't know. I wasn't like one of these kids who was like, I'm going to be a filmmaker when I'm 10.
Yeah.
I didn't know that until I was 20.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, sometimes it takes a while, you know. I mean, usually, you know, kids don't really know what they want to do, you know. And then later on you develop your the things you like to do, you know, and things that interest you and things like that, you know. So that's pretty cool. And after college, what did you do? Did you continue to make films after that?
We did. We made a few short films.
Mm-hmm.
I started working for a producer, a Canadian producer, as his like assistant. So that was like my day job. And then we made some other short films through Canadian. We have a grant system in Canada that helps.
Oh, wow.
Fund short films. Yeah. So we used that money and made a few shorts that were not, I don't think they were fully me, but they were an experimentation phase for me. And like how to direct actors better, how to try different styles with the camera. But they weren't necessarily successful films.
I see. Yeah. You usually make short films to market yourself, right? To show people, showcase your abilities and things like that. Because usually the public doesn't get to see them, right?
Yeah.
They're in festivals and things like that, you know. So so you get a lot of chance to practice and show what you can do and everything.
Exactly.
Right? Did you do any feature films after that?
No.
So you stayed working with short films
now. Well, I've been writing something, you know, I've been writing a few things over the years. But since I made Motherland, the feature I was writing, which is similar to Motherland, I kind of said, I've already done it now. I feel satisfied. So I'm writing something else. But it takes a while to write a good script.
Yeah, I bet, you know. And then to cast the whole film and things like that. Obviously, to finance it, it's a big deal.
Definitely.
It's a big deal.
It takes a while.
Yeah. Well, you're very courageous, you know. I mean, to undertake, you know, projects like that, you know. I don't know that I could, you know. It's like, I mean, a feature film, it's like, wow, it's too big. But I guess when you learn how to do it, when you know what you're doing, it's you can handle it.
You just you break it down into small parts, like anything, right?
Yeah, like a business.
Exactly. Yeah. Just little by little, because if you try to look at it all at once, it's so overwhelming.
Right. So everybody's got their role in the film, whatever they do.
Yeah.
And then it comes together pretty much.
Yeah. It's like, you know, it's like just like it starts with me on my couch listening to music and writing some words down and ends up here, like in California, like, you know, like it's and it's like those that's over years, you know, that's not like overnight.
Right.
But you have to kind of just little by little, and then you add people in, like Caitlin, my producer, is always from the beginning involved, and I share ideas with her. Mm-hmm. But the other people, like the cinematographer, the editor, the costume designer, the production designer, these people get added slowly, you know,
yeah,
depending on the process, usually closer to when you're shooting.
Right. And who does the casting? Do you do the casting or do you get someone?
Well, traditionally, we've done our own casting, which is a lot of work.
Yeah.
It's a lot of work.
You got to go through a lot of people to figure out who fits the role.
Yeah, and it's like even just the bureaucracy of like getting people to submit tapes. But for Motherland, for the short film, we worked with a casting director, and then also I knew, because it's Iranian, some of the cast is Iranian.
Okay.
It's a little harder to find those people.
Right.
But we did a mix of like our own casting and the casting director in Toronto.
Right, right. And so with Motherland, how did you get this idea to do a film about your dad? Did you always want to do that, or
it like sort of like came over time? I think I started wanting to connect more with my Iranian roots the older I got. And I thought of, you know, maybe you can relate to this, but after somebody passes, there's a grieving period that I think you're kind of like just processing things for a number of years. And then I started to think of like his stories. And I love period pieces. I love using period pieces as a way to shed light on the present.
Right.
Like things we want to think about now. So I like that this was like a period of time. It was like over Thanksgiving where this person's meeting the parents. And a lot of it's very true. Like what happened was very true. I dramatized, you know, certain things, but a lot of it's very true. And I just wanted to challenge myself because the film I made before was very real, like gritty, you know, loose camera, like, and then this is very formalized.
Mm.
So I wanted to challenge myself. I wanted to make film about Iranians that it was a humanizing portrayal of them. And then I wanted to honor my dad. So it was like all these things kind of combined.
Yeah. And does this film have a big cast or
No. Okay. No big cast for me.
Yeah. I mean, usually in short films you don't, you know.
Yeah.
You have to tell the story quickly.
Yeah, yeah, and you're not really working with big casting. Some people do have big people in their short films, but it's not as common.
Yeah. So you have the character of your father. Mm-hmm. Who else is in the film?
There's a character of my mother.
Okay.
Who's the character's name is Katie, and she is a big part of the film too. It's like them, you know. It's the story of Bobak going to meet his fiance's parents at a Thanksgiving thing in Iowa. And he's not received well by her father.
Oh, wow.
Which is based on my grandfather.
Yeah.
My real-life grandfather.
Right, yeah. Usually there's a clash of cultures in cases like this, you know, and it's difficult, you know. It's very difficult.
Yeah.
I know when I first connected, I came here when I was 16. And I connected with a girl that wasn't my my religion. And my mom totally, like, wouldn't come and see me, you know, the whole time. And she was just a girlfriend. We were teenagers, for crying out loud, you know. But it happens. It happens. I can totally understand. And that was difficult for him.
And it's the influence of what was on TV at the time. You know, it was showing men who look like him burning the American flag, of course, these things. So it was the influence of the propaganda, you know, that was like on this sort of this all-American guy, this father. Mm-hmm. And that was true. My grandfather didn't speak to my mom for 2 years.
Really?
Said, "You're marrying an Iranian? I'm not talking to you."
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So that's kind of where that inspiration came from.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I know. She must have known that it was not going to be easy to bring him home.
She did. She definitely did. But there was a bit of a naivete about that. And I think in the character of Katie, I wrote in this kind of naiveness to her. Mm. I mean, they're a young couple in the film, and I think they're both a little naive.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I see.
Yeah.
Who is the star of the film?
His name is Behtosh Fazlali. He's Iranian-Canadian.
Mm-hmm.
He plays Babak, who's my father.
Right.
And he is incredible. He actually won. In Canada, we have Canadian Screen Awards, which is like our Golden Globe ceremony.
Uh-huh.
And he won an award for his performance. He's incredible.
Yeah? Wow. Mm-hmm. How did you get him?
I knew him. I'd seen him in some other short films.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, in terms of like Iranian-Canadian actors, there's not very many at all in Canada.
Yeah.
But he was strong. I'd seen him in another film, and I was like, he is talented. And I'd met him in Vancouver. I was shooting a TV show out in Vancouver, and I went for a hike with him. And after the hike, I was like, he has so much in common with my father.
Wow.
They're so similar. They grew up in a similar way. I think he'll understand the story, and he did.
Mm. Did he grow up in Iran too, or
until he was about 6 years old, he was in Iran, uh-huh. And then him and his mother fled as refugees. It was a different time because Behtosh is my age, both 37. So we at that time it was different Iran than my dad grew up in. The regime was now ruling when Behtosh was growing up. So they had to flee. I'm not sure exactly why, but and then he kind of grew up with his mom, more or less raising him. And my father also just grew up with his mom raising him. So there's a lot of similarities.
Yeah. Did your dad have a big family too?
I mean, a lot of Iranians have very big families because they have a lot of uncles and aunts and that type of thing. But my dad himself was one of three boys. He was the only one that left Iran first, and his brothers came to Canada much later.
Right.
But his dad was actually murdered in Iran when he was like 9. So he grew up without a dad. And after their dad passed away, they didn't grow up. They grew up in a humble way, not a lot of money. But the family came together to almost raise these boys as a family. Let's help this woman who's alone with her three boys.
Right.
And help them to get an education, which they did. And they just did whatever they could to survive.
Yeah. How old was your dad when they left?
Well, my dad left on his own at 19.
Oh, really?
For the U.S.
So not with his mom. He left
alone. Yeah, his mom stayed behind. His brother stayed behind. He was the first one to
go. Yeah. Did they join him later?
Yeah, they did. Like in the 90s.
Wow.
So it was like 20 years of being away from your...
Yeah. Was he able to be in touch with him at all?
Yeah, he would fly...
By phone.
And in the film, the film takes place in 1979, but... In the film, there's a big component of Babak talking to his mom on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously in the late 70s, the connection on the phone is so bad and like you have to kind of scream. And he was connected by letters, by phone. And then eventually when he had more money, he would fly his mom out to Canada.
Yeah.
And she helped raise me. Like when I was a baby, she kind of came and helped take care of me.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember actually calling my family, and it was so expensive to call overseas from here that we would get like quarters at the store and go to a payphone and call that way, you know. And so you put in all these quarters to talk to your family, and the connection, like you said, sucked back then, you know. So it was just like, I mean, we were even writing letters, you know. I mean, who does that today,
I know. Yeah.
But people don't understand how different the world was. You know, people that grow up now don't understand how different the world was back then.
Yes,
you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's interesting you say that because at the end of the film, one of the last scenes that's very dramatic is Babak is at a payphone putting in all his quarters.
Really?
Yeah. And he's trying to connect. And the connection's so bad and he wants to go home desperately.
Yeah.
At the beginning of the film, his mom... is worried about him, and he's like, no, I'm good. And then by the end of the film, he's like, oh, I need to go home. I need money. But he's at the payphone, and he's...
Wow. Mm-hmm. So 1979, that was the year of the revolution, right?
Yeah.
And where were you? You were out here.
I wasn't born yet.
That's right.
Yeah.
What am I talking about? I mentioned that early on, but
about yeah. 8 years later, I was born, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was 79. I was 19 years old. So I remember it very well. And we saw it on TV and stuff like that. And yeah, they took the hostages that remained in captivity for like, what, 444 days yeah. or something, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, exactly.
And I remember at that time, the show Nightline was launched just for that. And then it continued, you know, mm-hmm. with Ted Koppel. And yeah, that was an interesting time, you know, because I don't think anybody here was thinking a lot about Iran, you know, before that, you know, and it sort of just came out of nowhere and suddenly we're in big trouble, you know, and this affected the relationships with America, obviously, mm-hmm. with the West, and yeah, and how do you get those people out, you know?
Yeah.
And I know there was, I remember there was an attempt to get them out with helicopters, and it failed. And, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, to be a hostage is probably the biggest hell you can go through, you know? And so I feel for those people, you know, and everybody that left obviously was very lucky, you know, not to be involved in all that, mm-hmm. you know, but, so then, now that was a. So before that, there was the Shah, right?
Yeah.
And life was a lot very Western-like and, mm-hmm. and things like that, right?
It was. Yeah.
Now, why did the revolution happen? What were their reasons for toppling the regime there?
I'm probably going to butcher this because there's so many layers to it. But I think
right.
overall there was probably this dissatisfaction with. How Western Iran had become, and then also like I think dividing between the rich and the poor, like who were getting richer and who were staying poor.
Yeah,
I think there was obvious. There's so many different reasons.
Right.
I think there was also you know like a part of like the religious part
right.
that were dissatisfied with maybe. What was happening, but I'm not sure how big of an influence that was, and then it became huge.
Right.
But there was some dissatisfaction, and then the Shah had done some terrible things to a lot
yeah,
of people.
Yeah, he was corrupt too, right?
Yeah.
In many ways.
Yeah.
But the U.S. supported him, and that's why they were taking American hostages, right? Was that the reason?
I think the Ayatollah became like a godlike figure for certain people at the time because they didn't know what he was going to do.
Right. Yeah.
He was in Paris and then they came back on the airplane and there's that footage of him coming off the airplane. Uh-huh. But I think that there was this dissatisfaction towards US involvement in Iranian politics.
Right.
And then how close the Shah was to sort of in bed with the US, and I think there was a, you know,
right.
this like dissatisfaction towards that, but
yeah.
Yeah, there's so many reasons. It's like a whole book, you know, to know why the revolution started.
Right.
Just touching on a few points, and it's right. like not like all Iranians were on one side or the other. There's many different feelings about that within Iran.
Right.
I think my film is not about this at all. My film's about two people who want to. Well, one person who wants to have a good life and
right.
as in love. That's my film is a character piece.
Right.
But I think this sort of, well, again, the part I show at the beginning of the film is a little bit of 30 seconds of archival footage of what was on the news on Nightline.
Nightline,
yeah,
right.
at Koppel and ABC News. And what's portrayed is not all of Iran. What's portrayed is a few people who are dissatisfied and, you know, doing chaotic things. But of
right.
course, you get painted with a broad brush. All the Iranians got painted with a broad brush.
Right.
So that's, for me, the archival footage was about showing people what was on TV, how that looks to any American, you know, and post-Vietnam, the country is divided. So you see
yeah.
that, and that's scary, of course. That's
yeah.
scary. So to be this Middle Eastern man with a big beard and... who looks like the people in the papers and on TV, you're going to face a lot of challenges.
Right.
But he's just a person who just wants to be in love. Have,
so now, how did you find out the story? Did he sit and tell you about his life sometimes and things like that? Or did you learn from your mom?
Yeah, I would. He, because he passed away, I couldn't go back to him and ask him everything. Because I started writing this in 2021, many years after he passed away. But his brothers are in Toronto, so I'm close to them, my uncles. And so I asked them. And they had so many stories. And then my mom was an amazing resource because she was with him. So I was able to kind of, I interviewed people. I recorded the interviews. I transcribed the interviews. And I would go through and start to think about, oh, this is, I think what was the amazing thing is you learn about a parent who's passed away, you understand them more after. Because you're like, oh, I didn't know this. You know, all these stories all of a sudden.
I know all the family members, everybody's got some memory about. I know we do that sometimes, you know, when we sit with cousins and uncles and stuff like that. We're like, oh, really? I never knew that happened. You know?
Exactly, yeah. Things like that. Always something new I find out every time I visit them.
Yeah.
Because I think they suppress a lot of things. And then once you start asking them, they're actually happy to talk about it.
Yeah. Now, a little bit about your mom. Did she have siblings also when she grew up?
Yeah, she had one sister. They were about 9 years apart. So it was,
I see. And was she supporting her when... Because your grandfather obviously was not supporting her decision. But was her sister supportive?
She was. I mean, my mom met my dad, she was in her mid-20s. So her sister would have been a teenager.
Oh,
however, my aunt actually said, you know, to her dad after 2 years, you got to accept him now.
Yeah.
This is enough.
Yeah.
And I think my aunt had a big influence on my grandfather opening up. And then in the end, my grandfather and my dad became like father and son. As soon as he saw him as a real person, he loved him. They loved each other.
Yeah.
A lot.
Wow.
Yeah.
And what about your grandmother? What was she doing all this?
There is a character in the film based on my grandmother who, you know, is a woman born in the early, I guess born in the 1920s, and is just maybe not as harsh, but definitely okay to go along with her husband.
Mm.
Whatever her husband says, that's what the house is doing.
Yeah.
She also said to my mom something to the effect of a blue bird and a red bird don't mix, like, i.e. don't mix races, you know. So it was a different type of prejudice, but it was a lot more subtle. But then again, once they knew them, once I was born, they were like, we're all family now.
Yeah, eventually they come around, right? Mm. So your grandfather, 2 years later, took him to finally accept your father.
Well, I think all my mom's cousins in Alberta were like meeting my father. So like they would go to Alberta and meet all my mom's family except my mom's parents. Mm. They would go on this like, and everybody loved him. And I think that influence on my grandfather was like, okay, I guess I'll stop being stubborn.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did he stay in touch with the friends he came with?
I don't think he did.
No,
which
huh?
is, I have no idea what happened to them.
Oh,
I'm so curious.
Yeah.
I think a lot of them went back to Iran, and they probably had to serve in the war, like the Iran-Iraq war.
Yeah.
I don't even know who's alive, who's not. I have no idea.
Yeah. And so he became a doctor pretty much early on in his life, right? How old was he?
Well, he was, like He went to university. I guess he started because he came to the U.S. when he was 19, but he had to kind of like, he probably started university undergrad when he was 20.
Mm.
I think he was like 30 something when he became a doctor. Yeah, I guess kind of young.
Yeah. And finally he was seeing some money, right? When
finally.
After many years of not.
Oh, yeah. And he went into massive debt doing medical school.
Really? Yeah.
Yeah. So it took, I feel like we were more financially stable when I was like I don't know. Early teens, that's when he finally, I think, felt relief. It took a long time. And also because my mom was bringing us up and she worked, but she didn't graduate with a university degree because she was having kids.
Mm-hmm.
So really my dad was the provider and he had three kids and then he got divorced. So it's like he never really, I think he felt relief in his later life, but he lived a life of immense sacrifice.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As all immigrants really do.
Yeah. Yeah. It is a big step, you know, for sure. Is your mom still around now?
She is, yeah.
She is. What does she think of the film?
She loves the film.
Really?
Yeah, she loves. She's very easygoing. My mom is very supportive of me, and she loves the film, and she was helping me, you know, with. She knew the writing. She knew the story. When she watched it, it wasn't a shock, but she was really, really happy. She actually was on the film as an extra.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's nice.
Yeah.
Was she supportive of you deciding to get into film in the first place?
Oh, yeah.
That's good. That helps, right?
She was, but my dad wasn't. So it was like like push-pull.
Yeah.
Iranian immigrant. They just want you to be financially okay.
Yeah. Know? They want to be practical, you know, get a real job kind of thing.
Yeah.
But you realize later in your life that you better do what you like, you know, or you're not going to make it, you know. It's many people get into stuff that they don't like, they don't want to do it, and they do it anyway, you know, because someone tells them to or because they think there'll be good money in it. But it's, you know, if you don't actualize yourself, you know, you're going to be in trouble, you know. So I salute you for doing that, you know, for taking the step and saying, you know, the hell with real jobs. This is my job.
Well, the thing, I think there's also this misconception that film is not a real job. And I'm like, it's such a real job, actually.
Right.
Like, when I'm directing TV, I wake up at 5 a.m. and I go to bed at midnight and I'm working all day. I'm putting in the time. Like, it's a job. And it's like this, you know, we're in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
You know, there's caterers. There's people who build sets, construction people.
Right.
Definitely real.
So you work in television now, too?
Mm-hmm.
What do you do there?
Direct.
You direct?
Mm-hmm.
What, like series or?
Yeah, like Netflix series. I've directed a lot of Canadian TV, but it's not well known here. But I've directed a Netflix series called Fakes, where I was the pilot director. I directed 4 episodes of that. Mm-hmm. And then more recently, this isn't out yet, but I directed the 3rd season of Netflix's Ginny and Georgia, which is one of their more successful shows. But it's very like teen stuff.
I see.
Yeah.
Can you relate to that? I mean, do you write for that show or
no?
There's different writers for the
show. I don't write for TV at this point. But directing for TV is much different than directing your own stuff because you're there to execute somebody else's vision.
I see.
And TV is usually trying to be more palatable, especially a show like Ginny and Georgia because it's for a really wide audience. But it is a little. There are some dark parts to it. It's relatable in the sense that it's a show for women by women and deals with some relatable themes of growing up as a teenage girl. And
Yeah. That's cool. How did you get that job?
Many years of... So after Firecrackers came out in 2018, I started shadowing. I got an agent and I started shadowing on TV sets, shadowing directors on all sorts of sets, like Netflix sets, HBO sets, CBC, which is Canadian sets. And then eventually I started from the very bottom at like children's TV.
Mm-hmm.
And then you like work your way slowly up.
I see.
But TV is very, it's a lot of pressure. It's a lot of pressure and it's a pressure cooker environment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You don't have, I mean, you have more deadlines than you would with your own films. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. Obviously your own films, you have deadlines, but the TV is you have to make your days, meaning you have to get all the scenes on the board that day, you must make them. Mm-hmm. And a lot of blame goes on to directors if you don't make the day, even if it's not your fault.
Yeah. Is it like, I mean, is it reasonable what they give you sometimes?
No.
No, huh?
It's never, especially nowadays, like with streaming and like the demands of to put out content is so high that they try to really cram in a lot into a little.
Mm.
So that's always, every show is about, what can we rewrite to make this day achievable? And then, of course, a showrunner doesn't want to rewrite it because they're attached to a scene and this is important. And then it's like, how can we shoot this fast but good? And it's a puzzle. It's very challenging.
Yeah. And we have a few minutes left on Motherland. Can people see it anywhere?
They can. It's on Vimeo.
Okay.
It's a Vimeo staff pick. So if you go to Vimeo and look at the staff picks, it will be there. Or you can just Google Motherland, Vimeo, and it should come up.
That's nice. So it's a staff favorite. Is that what you said?
It is a staff pick. Yeah, they have
a staff pick.
Certain Vimeo has certain films that they really like and they promote, and it's one of those.
So it sounds like a lot of people love the film.
Seems like it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. It's getting. We had a screening at UTA in Beverly Hills yesterday, and it was well attended, and it really reaches a lot of, I think Iranians feel very validated by seeing the film. And yeah. I think that makes me really happy.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it brings, like, probably a lot of people can relate to those stories.
They can, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But obviously this is meant for the wider audience than just Iranians.
Yes, for sure, yeah.
And so it's very cool that people are attracted to it, even though, you know, they're not really connected with the period, with the stories. And
oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, I think it's important, for me it was important to like educate people about what happened, but also when you write a good character piece, anybody can enjoy it as long as it's impactful.
Right. Know? Yeah. And so are you on the long list of Oscars now, on the short list?
It comes out December 17th, so we'll see.
Oh, okay. Soon, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. How many films are competing? Do you know?
Like
hundreds?
300? 200, over 200.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a lot.
Yeah. But if you have a good film, it'll stand out, you know?
Sure. Yeah, we hope. We really believe in our film, so... And people seem to be resonating with it. So we hope at least we're on the short list.
Awesome.
Yeah.
And what's in your future? Do you have any projects that you really want to do?
I'm writing my second feature. I think it's really important I make my own stuff.
Yeah.
And not get too lost in, because a lot of people send me scripts and stuff, but I'm like, no, you know, what's more important is my own things.
Yeah.
So writing that and then continuing to direct television.
Yeah. Very cool. Mm-hmm. Well, very ambitious woman and very talented, hardworking, right?
Thank you.
We learned a lot about you. So people go to Vimeo, check out Motherland, and I'm going to check it out for sure, you know, because I didn't even get a trailer. I don't know why, but sometimes I get trailers. But
yeah, there is a trailer.
There is a trailer.
Yeah.
Where is it, on YouTube or something?
YouTube, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll look it up then and see.
Okay.
How long is the film?
24 minutes.
So that's pretty long,
it's
right?
It's a long short film. Yeah, it's long.
Yeah.
But I think it has tension, and hopefully it holds your interest for that long.
Awesome. Well, Jasmine, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
You're full of stories and everything, and you're still young, so there's a lot more to learn over the years. Caitlin, thank you for sitting by and supporting us. And how can people find you if they want to contact you, social media or anything?
Social media, you can look me up. You can just search my full name, Jasmine Mozafari. My handle's Jazz_Mozafari. Or my website is jasminemozafari.com.
Cool. And is there a website for the movie too?
Not for the movie. We have a company website. Caitlin and I have our own company called Prowler Film, which we have our own website. But... all the information is on my website specifically.
Uh-huh.
Or if you follow us on Instagram, motherland_film_, my Instagram, you'll see all the updates there.
Sounds good. Well, thank you. I wish you a lot of success. I'd like to see you at the Oscars. And you have a good chance, I think, you know, just based on the response you got in other festivals and everything, you know. So, so you must feel very proud.
I am.
Yeah, awesome.
Yeah.
Well, all the best to you. I wish you a lot of continued success.
Thank you.
And come back after the Oscars. Don't forget us minions when when you become a big filmmaker.
Never. Yeah.
We'll awesome. Okay. All right, everybody. Thank you all for listening, and we'll see you all tomorrow.
Listening to Sam in the Morning, only on LA Talk Radio.